This is the takeaway for Thursday, October 12th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Glad to be back with you today. And we begin this hour in Northern California, where multiple wildfires north of San Francisco have scorched the earth and destroyed thousands of homes.
When the power went out, we woke up and I checked out the front yard, and the wind was just howling through here, and very large ambers were striking down, and we didn't have any time to get anything. We just had to go.
It's agonizing. I can't describe it. I mean, people, I don't know. I can't. It's awful.
It's just sad to see our beautiful city. I mean, that's the bad thing. And we know a lot of friends have just lost everything. You know, that's really, really sad.
The images from Northern California are incredible. Entire neighborhoods in Mendocino and Sonoma counties reduced to ash. Cars burned, trees still standing as they burn from the inside. At least 23 people have died, and with many people missing, there are concerns that that number could go up. 8,000 firefighters are battling the Northern California wildfires on the ground and from the air. Crews have come in from surrounding states, but the high winds and dry conditions are making those fires hard to control. Paul Duncan is a division chief for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, currently working in Mendocino County, and he lives nearby in Hidden Valley. I asked Chief Duncan how his crews are doing.
They're doing well. We're taking good care of them. They are putting some hard hours in, some very laborious days and nights trying to keep this fire in check, and they're working their hearts out. So I appreciate them every day.
Chief, what do we need to know about these fires? Not only the size of the fire and how widespread it is, but how hot it's burning. What are you encountering here?
We're encountering a lot of wind-driven fires. We had a lot of rain in the winter, which produced a really significant grass crop for us. And that grass crop now is dry, and we're experiencing a lot of wind-driven activity, and that the wind will be blowing with a low humidity, and that's another thing that's really affecting the explosive fire behavior. So when we get these winds on top of the dry fuels, and we're all the way at the end of the burning season, which tends to give us the peak fire behavior, just as a bad recipe. The fires are difficult to control, difficult to get in front of, and hot. It's like a blowtorch, really. It's like holding the hairdryer to a fire, and it just fans the flame.
Mm. There was one report, Chief, in the New York Times that said that these fires burn and move faster than firefighters can run.
Correct. One of the fatalities here on our fire that I'm currently working in Mendocino County, the family could not escape because the fire front hit them so fast. The family couldn't get out of the way, and neither could that's the issue with the firefighters. So what we have to do is pull back until the wind slows, and then we can get in front of the fire.
Correct. Can you talk a little bit about the physical toll on your firefighters when they're out there, what the conditions are like, and how it feels to be fighting fire in this smoldering earth with all this hot wind?
It's arduous. So not only does this wind and the low humidity affect the fire behavior, it also dries the firefighters out. It takes the humidity out of you. We are just like a fuel out there, so we have to keep them hydrated. Make sure they have plenty of water, they're well fed, and they are putting in 24, sometimes 36-hour shifts because we don't have relief, and we're rotating as many folks as we can. But they are putting in some serious time. It can get exhausting. They'll take a nap sometimes in the middle of the night just to kind of recharge themselves during the night and get right back at it just a couple hours later. So I've been out there. The smoking conditions are a real challenge to work in, hard on the lungs, and then just the work where we're putting them in for so many hours, just hard on the body.
Sure, Chief. 24, 36-hour shifts, as you mentioned, without relief. Is there enough relief? Are there enough personnel on the ground there? Do you need more?
We can always use more. Never say we're overstaffed, but we have resources coming from all over the country. We appreciate so much of the help that's been sent. We know FEMA's now involved, so we are getting resources. Just understand, in so many fires and so many fronts, it's hard to have enough personnel. One of these, just a 70,000-acre fire, would take normally 2,500 to 3,000 people working it to get it extinguished, and we have several of those.
Cal Fire also uses prison inmates to help fight fires like this.
Yes.
How does that coordinate?
Several thousand of our prison firefighters, they're an integral part of the Cal Fire response. They are really the boots on the ground. They are the firefighters that get out there and put the hand line in right next to the fire to keep it from going further. So they are right in the heat of the battle. They are a critical component of our firefighting, and they are very underappreciated, I think, on the public side. But on our side, we know the labor that they put in, and our organization is one that is a rehabilitation. So our intent is to get these folks out and give them something that they could do if they were to get out of prison, and gives them some work history.
Chief, given the conditions that you're talking about and how hard your firefighters are working, I mean, you're working in Mendocino County right now. Your home is in nearby Hidden Valley. How many of your firefighters are working on the line right now, knowing the fires could shift to where they live?
Many of them. We lost our home during the Valley Fire, and I was deployed on that. So I can relate to the firefighters and their home being threatened. We have several now who have lost homes. And those that are threatened, we are letting off duty to go home and deal with family, deal with their home, and then to return to work because we need them back.
You just said that you lost your own home back in 2015 when you were fighting
fire.
Is your home safe now, Chief?
It's safe for now. Fire's been making a couple of runs to the east, and that's the Tubbs Fire out of Napa County. So we're keeping a close eye on it. But again, I'm up here on the fire line, and we're doing our best up here. This is where I'm focusing my attention.
What about civilians in the neighborhood there where you're working? Have they been chipping in?
Oh, absolutely. It's especially moving. I was approached in the store as I was leaving just yesterday, picking up some groceries for the crew, and a family approached and wanted to give me a case of water to take to the firefighters. I turned it down, but it's a gesture that's extremely appreciated. And just it shows the humanity and those that want to help.
Well, it seems like everyone out there really appreciates what you and these thousands of firefighters are doing, Chief. What do you need right now?
We need the weather to change is what we really need. As far as supplies and as far as needs, we're good. We're just putting in hard time. We're putting in the work and looking forward to just getting that change, getting that cool down. We're doing our best to keep our firefighters rehabilitated, so hopefully we can get them a 24-hour off after they've been on the fire line for 24 hours, but then they're right back to it.
Well, Chief Paul Duncan, I hope you get all those things. I hope you get the change in the weather that you're looking for, and certainly I hope that your firefighters get a rest. Everyone appreciates what you're doing, Chief.
Thank you, Todd.
Paul Duncan is a division chief for Cal Fire working in Mendocino County. Well, it's not just the people in the fire's immediate path that are at risk. The air quality index reported by the Environmental Protection Agency this week shows that the air is unhealthy across large swaths of Northern California. Smoke and ash blow on the wind all along the coast as far as 50 miles from the fires, and a smoke advisory is in effect for the 7.4 million people in the 9-county Bay Area region right around San Francisco. Dr. Zab Mesenafar is a pulmonologist and executive vice chair of the Department of Medicine at Cedars Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
How big of a risk is smoke from wildfires like this to human health for people who might not be anywhere near the flames?
Well, Todd, there are three categories of the impact: on short term, long term, and the impact on water. The impact in terms of short term is because of gases and particulate matters. Gases in the fire are carbon monoxide, ozone, nitrous dioxide, sulfur dioxide, benzene, aldehyde, and aromatic hydrocarbons. These gases are extremely unsafe for vulnerable populations such as elderly, children, patients with lung disease, heart disease, pregnant women. So these have tremendous impact. The second piece is the particulate matters, which are the particles of the ash. And they are classified normally as PM10, which means like size of 10 micron or more, or PM2.5. They're 2.5 micron in diameter. The large particles get large in the upper airways, and these patients have tremendous symptoms such as cough, irritation, wheeze, irregular heartbeats, phlegm. And so these obviously increase the risk of infection, emergency room visits, pneumonia, you name it.
Dr. Mosenifar, Heather Bailey was evacuated from her home in Northern California. She joined us on the program yesterday. She has asthma. Listen.
I have asthma, so I definitely am feeling it and have had to get treated once already. And there's a lot of people walking around with masks on, especially like contractor-style masks, to like help filter out the smoke for sure.
Dr. Heather Bailey has asthma. She has a reactive airway, and all that smoke and soot has to be pretty bad for people like her.
That's correct, because, you know, the asthmatics, asthma is the irritation of the airways, and any kind of irritant, such as these, when she talked about these particles, when she inhales those, they are tremendous irritants. What they do, they irritate, they start this cascade of reaction in the upper airways and her bronchial tubes, and she presents with the symptoms of wheezing and asthma. The best is really to stay indoors. If, as she commented, to wear those N95 masks if you have to go outside, and make sure that you take your inhalers properly.
There have been reports lately in the scientific literature, Doctor, that smog and particulate from normal pollution on days of really bad smog, that asthma attacks and cardiovascular events go up and that more people die, it's as simple as that, in emergency rooms. When a fire like this happens, is there evidence that that kind of immediate reaction on morbidity and mortality is a factor?
There is suggestion that even PM10s increases people's risk for pneumonia and mortality. And what you talked about is the long-term impact of the 2.5. Those are the generally urban fires.
So of the 7.4 million people that we talked about in the Bay Area who are under a smoke advisory right now, do you have any sense of how many might be at real risk?
Well, if you think of about 10 to 15% of general population have asthma, so I would say that about 10, 15% of that 7 million are increased risk.
And that's a lot of people far away from where the flames are destroying homes, and firefighters are on the line in counties around San Francisco. Dr. Zab Mosenifar of Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us here on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. 22 days after Hurricane Maria made landfall, life for many people in Puerto Rico is still grim. Only about 10% of the island has power now. 63% of the island has water access, which is an improvement. But what about access to food?
I spoke with one of my cousins in Puerto Rico this morning. She basically was telling me that she was really concerned that whenever she goes to a grocery store somewhere in Puerto Rico, she lives in Caguas, it basically looks empty. It looks like they haven't received their inventory. So at the time, they just buy whatever they can find.
That's Nicole Acevedo, a Puerto Rican native whose family is in Puerto Rico. She's been updating us here on The Takeaway for several weeks, and she talked to us yesterday. Federal authorities and relief groups are delivering emergency meals to the island, but according to reporting by The Guardian, FEMA and its partners are only providing an estimated 200,000 meals a day for the needs of more than 2 million people. Columnist Richard Wolf reported from Puerto Rico on the food shortages for The Guardian U.S., and he joins me now from San Juan. Richard Wolf, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Richard, you report this shocking number that I mentioned, 200,000 meals a day to meet the needs of 2 million people, and quote an official saying, we are 1.8 million meals short. How did this happen?
What we've seen post-Maria is frankly a man-made disaster. The response 3 weeks on from the hurricane in terms of not getting food but getting meals to people has been just chaotic and inadequate by the federal government's own numbers. Now, 2 million meals a day is actually only one meal a day for 2 million people, and most people don't live off one meal a day. So the meals are not getting there. The food, there is food on the island, but the meals that are getting to people are in the 200,000 range are frankly military meals. And you know, that might be fine for a frontline troop in a war zone, but you cannot keep a civilian population eating these very heavy meals for any length of time.
Now, contrast meals with food. You said there is food on the island. We don't want to suggest that if they're 1.8 million meals short, that there's that many people malnourished or starving.
Well, people are hungry. I mean, I've met people who've said that they're chewing on roots and drinking rainwater. So, you know, there's food on the island, but to get that food, you need to go to a supermarket. That means you need to have cash. The economy has seized up. The ATMs don't work because there's no electricity. So there may be food on the island, but you can't turn that into meals. And when the food agencies distribute in very limited fashion, and remember, 200,000 of a 2 million meal target is just 10% of the need. But when they distribute food, it's uncooked. So, and there's no point in giving people uncooked rice, because even if they have, say, a propane gas tank, they don't have water to cook the rice. If they have any water at all, they're using it to drink. And like I said, a lot of people are using rainwater. So cooking is exceptionally difficult. Buying food is exceptionally difficult. This is a humanitarian crisis facing American citizens. And by the federal government's own numbers, they are not meeting the needs, the basic fundamental human needs, 3 weeks on after the hurricane.
Richard, the president tweets today, and I'm quoting, "We cannot keep FEMA, the military and first responders who've been amazing under the most difficult circumstances, in Puerto Rico forever." The president seems to be suggesting that this operation may need to wind down. You're reporting a food crisis. What are officials on the ground saying?
They all think it needs to ramp up. For a start, everyone knows that FEMA is hampered by massive bureaucracy and red tape. It cannot move quick enough to get the food crisis met. It wants to go through bidding process, you know, to get contracts for NGOs. It takes weeks and weeks to do that. Meanwhile, people are going hungry. So there really is, there's a need to ramp up, not ramp down. It's not clear from the president's public comments and from his visit that he truly appreciates the scale of this challenge. You know, people talk about water, people having access to water, but if you are living high up and there are no pumps working because there's no electricity, then having water available, it doesn't mean to say you can get water. So the statistics don't tell the story. This is like Katrina, but 100 times worse, facing a vastly bigger population of Americans.
Richard Wolf, you also report that there's a contract to provide cooked meals, not military meals, but regular cooked meals. Chef Jose Andres, who many people have heard of, his company contracted to provide 20,000 meals a day, but that this contract is soon to expire. What's going to happen?
Well, it actually has now expired since publishing the story. It's actually not a company. It's an NGO. It's a network of chefs. They're working with local chefs. Remember, these places are there. The local businesses are closed. There are no people, you know, going to a convention center or an arena. So these facilities are available. People aren't getting paid. So they're volunteering their time. And the contract has ended. It's only 20,000 meals that FEMA wanted, even though there's a much bigger need. And as the contract ends, he's looking for private donations. But in all likelihood, he'll have to wind things up as well, because FEMA cannot respond to this crisis, whether it's through incompetence or sheer inertia. It doesn't have the capacity to get 2 million meals out every day for 3.5 million people.
Shortages of water remain in Puerto Rico weeks after Hurricane Maria, and emergency meals going to the island, not nearly enough. Richard Wolf reports that people are hungry in Puerto Rico. Richard Wolf with The Guardian, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We reached out to FEMA officials to talk to us about food availability in Puerto Rico. We didn't receive a reply. President Trump is expected to announce tomorrow that he'll officially begin backing the United States away from the international deal curtailing Iran's nuclear program. The president has the option of decertifying Iran's compliance with that deal and throwing the question of new sanctions to Congress. The lawmakers are speaking up.
If we're serious about cracking down on Iran, the best path forward is to stick with the deal, despite what I view as its flaws, and hold Iran strictly to its obligations.
The sensible course, then, is to decline to certify the deal, begin the work of strengthening it and counteracting Iranian aggression with the threat of sanctions and military action if necessary.
That was Democratic Congressman Elliot Engel and Republican Senator Tom Cotton there. If the president does decertify Iran's compliance, Congress will have 60 days to decide whether to impose new sanctions on Iran. Arian Tabatabai is a fellow at Harvard University's Belfer Center and a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Arian, the president has certified the agreement twice during his presidency already, so why change tactics now?
Well, I think there's a lot of internal disagreements within the White House and the administration. On the one hand, you have the ideologues who are sort of on the same page as President Trump, who want to decertify the deal regardless of whether or not it's working, regardless of Iranian compliance. On the other hand, you have folks like Secdef Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson, who believe that, okay, this may not be perfect, and of course they distrust Iran tremendously, but they also believe that pulling out of the deal now would come at a greater cost for the United States. It would have an impact on U.S. credibility and ability to lead on future multilateral processes. So this internal push and pull, I think, is the reason why we're starting to see this emerging policy now. And certainly what seems to be the end result here is some sort of a concession between those two parts of the White House. And it seems to be sort of a telling President Trump, okay, you can have your decertification, you can indicate to your base that you've done your job, while at the same time not rocking the boat too much and not having sanctions imposed, which would create more chaos ultimately.
But doesn't that then put Republicans in Congress in a really tough position?
Well, Todd, I think that's exactly part of the problem, is that so many Republicans, moderate Republicans, were very much critical of the nuclear deal. But they also understand that this is no longer just about Iran. And so what we are likely to see here is going to be a bit of a split among the Republican Party in a way that we hadn't seen before on this issue. So I think that's the space to watch, actually, in the next few weeks. You know, who is likely to side with the Democrats on this?
Well, Arianna Tabatabai, I have to say that the situation is a little bit confusing as we await the president's announcement. I mean, on the one hand, you say that Congress finds itself in a difficult spot, may make some maneuvers, and in fact choose not to impose new sanctions on Iran. On the other hand, there are voices from Congress that say military action could be on the table. The president's rhetoric has suggested that military action, a get tough approach, could be on the table. Which of these things is likely to win the day here?
I think there are enough, I might be optimistic here, but I think there are enough moderate Republicans who understand the situation very well and who know that opening up another war in the Middle East is just a terrible idea. You know, we're already stuck in Afghanistan and Iraq and have some sort of, cooperation with the Saudis on Yemen. I just don't see the United States getting involved in another war and doing well there. And with tensions escalating with North Korea, I think that there really needs to be some sort of solution that doesn't involve putting either troops on the ground in the Middle East or even just kind of going and having bombing campaigns and mowing the lawn as it goes. So I think that there is certainly pressure, you're right, on the hardliners side. Senator Tom Cotton recently gave a very sort of doom and gloom speech at the Council on Foreign Relations, saying that you have to kick your enemy when he's down, essentially. But I think that there are enough voices of moderation to avoid that.
Arian Tabatabai, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Arian Tabatabai is a fellow at Harvard University's Belfer Center. Nearly 2 years ago, we brought you the story of a young man who had his sights firmly fixed on getting to college. But Alex Diaz is a high school dropout and a former gang member who'd been to prison for a felony. And where Alex Diaz had been did not make a clear path to where he wanted to go.
A lot of people see you as like, you're not going to go nowhere, you're not going to get a job or even go back to school. I even felt like that at one time for hearing it so much. And I just had to overcome everybody's opinions and everybody's thoughts.
Well, that was January 2016, but today we wanted to bring you an update on Alex Diaz, because thanks to his hard work and the support of a group called College Bound Dorchester in Boston, Alex's dreams of college were finally realized. Takeaway producer Elizabeth Ross brings us this update from Boston.
In this business, you have to understand what you're doing. Simple, okay?
Down in a brightly lit basement classroom, a small group of students is learning the ins and outs of residential electrical wiring.
If you do not size and correct it, you know what happened? Fire. Fire, fire, ding, ding, ding.
Alex Diaz is among those listening intently during class here at the Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology.
Just me sitting here right now in college, I feel different, you know. I feel like I never actually committed no crimes or nothing like that. Like, I'm just, you know, so it feels good.
This college classroom is a world away from the life Diaz once knew when he dropped out of high school and joined a gang. That life led to Diaz serving 8 years in prison for armed robbery.
I mean, to put all those things in it like that.
Good question, Alex.
Now 31-year-old Diaz is pursuing a certificate in practical electricity at Benjamin Franklin. He hopes to eventually get an associate's degree in automotive or electrical technology. But even getting this far has been challenging.
You know, I did a lot of stuff. I know people that don't like me, you know, and it's just the cops, too. Cops around, you know, they still think you're doing the same old stuff, you know, and not realizing what you're really doing, you know. But at the end of the day, I don't let it get to me no more, you know. I just move forward and do what I got to do. And one day, sooner or later, they'll understand what I'm really doing.
When I first met Diaz nearly 2 years ago, he was working with college-bound Dorchester to obtain the equivalent of a high school diploma. The Boston nonprofit recently made that process a bit easier for Diaz and other former gang members and convicted felons. It's paying them to go to college. Students who qualify get $400 a week, or more than $20,000 a year.
They pay us to go to school, you know, and that helps us for our bills, you know. It kind of helps us to motivate us to go to school the next day and not focus on the streets more, and, you know, and help us support our family. Like my daughter, that's 11 years old, you know, she started school, so it's getting more expensive with her, so it helps out a lot.
College-bound Dorchester founder and CEO Mark Cullerton thinks it's well worth it. Massachusetts spends more than $55,000 a year to house a single prison inmate. Cullerton says his nonprofit targets the toughest youth from the most dangerous hotspots in Boston. They're not always successful.
We've had students shot and killed. We've had students that couldn't stick with the program and made bad choices and got arrested. And we even had a staff member that was shot in their line of work. But this is the nature of the world that these guys live in.
College-bound Dorchester says it's seen a 71% reduction in recidivism among its students. 150 of them are currently in college. But the program doesn't just want to transform its students' lives. It wants to use people like Diaz to influence others and transform their communities too. Take Diaz's older sister, Aixa. She helped look after Diaz's daughter while he was in prison. And at 33, she's now keen to get her high school diploma too.
I'm a certified nurse assistant. I'm licensed for that without a high school diploma. So I feel like with the high school diploma, I can succeed way more. And, you know, and they make my brothers and sisters proud of me, too.
Over the summer, she was among the many families cheering on her brother and all the students at a college-bound Dorchester graduation ceremony. As for Diaz, he says there's a lot that keeps him motivated to succeed in college. And it's not just because he's being paid to go there.
I think about going back to jail. You know, I think about if I just decide to not go to school for a week, there's going to be something, you know, that can happen bad, and I can't afford to go back to prison. I'm, you know, what you consider almost a three strike. So anything, I go back. So I just focus on my life, my future in school, and my daughter.
Diaz's daughter is one of the many who are looking up to him these days and willing him on to succeed. For The Takeaway, I'm Elizabeth Ross.
Well, it's been 3 weeks since one of the largest earthquakes in a century rocked Mexico, killing 369 people. 98 people lost their lives in another powerful quake that came just 2 weeks earlier. Now, recovery and rebuilding are underway all across the country.
When people think about destruction, they often think about sort of Hollywood absolute devastation, everything rubble. But that's not always the case, and that's also very dangerous because sometimes it's just cracks in buildings, pieces that are not quite in place, and that then become life-threatening for people.
That's the voice of Valeria Luiselli. She's an author from Mexico City. Valeria traveled down to Mexico to see her mother after the quake, and then she came to see us after she returned. She told us what she saw, what the earthquake means for Mexico, and what her mother went through when the ground began to tremble.
Every time there's an earthquake, and there's been a few lately, she immediately sends me a voice message. And the problem was that this time, after I heard from her During the earthquake, I did not hear from her again in many, many hours. When I finally did hear back from her, about 10 hours later, she told me what had happened, which was that she has a sliding door to get out of her house. And the sliding door had got stuck with the movement of the walls and of the earth. And she couldn't get out of the house during the earthquake and just had to wait until it was over while she saw everything around her just falling apart. Then she went out into the garden. She lives in a small community where there are several small adobe houses in a kind of nice big garden. And a lot of women, 60s and up, live there. And she met her 90-year-old neighbor in the garden, who was, of course, all shaken as well, who told her immediately, she just lay down on the ground while all this happened and watched things. She said that it was as if the earth was boiling, you know, that the movement of things on the ground was as if they were boiling inside a pot. And so this woman who's in her 90s, who's a survivor from the civil war in Spain, who was in a concentration camp, who came over to Mexico, she said, okay, you know what? What we have to do now is just relax. And she took out a tequila bottle and some ham, and they sat in the garden the rest of the afternoon just drinking a tequila bottle all the way down. That night, my mom went back home. She slept on the couch with the front door open because she didn't want to get stuck again. The next morning, she saw the situation, and we realized the next day that there were structural damages and the house was completely lost.
What about the state of mind of other people in Morelos who you saw? You talked about the structure of their houses and their streets. What about them and their outlook?
It's a really important question. The immediate reaction of many people who had not lost their houses was precisely to get together or to call over the brigades from Mexico City. Mexico City is a very well-organized city when it comes to natural disasters like an earthquake. We saw the 1985 earthquake, and there had been a huge institutional void at that time, which citizens basically had to come in and fill. So the city organized immediately. It was very inspiring to see. Help for picking up rubble came immediately. Food, immediately. In fact, many people in many towns and even in Mexico City said, please don't send more tacos over. But what didn't come immediately and needs to be there is psychological help, people that can help other people deal with trauma. Then we have to think of reconstruction, right? And there's a great group of architects that just formed as a response to this. They're called Reconstruct Mexico, Reconstruir Mexico, and it's organized into different sections. People who know how to work with adobe, for example, so that the government doesn't come into an indigenous community and say, here, we'll give you a block of concrete. These architects are paying attention to the materials as well as to countering the indiscriminate demolishing that often goes on after an earthquake.
And does all that come from the 85 experience as well, from the destruction there and then just sort of the wholesale rebuilding, maybe on the cheap, or maybe just clear it out, build it up, get past it attitude?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It does come from there. And like the architects that started this are architects who were probably in their teens and 20s and the 80s, and then now joined by architects of my generation who are now in their 30s. I don't remember the 85 earthquake, but it's kind of tattooed in our souls or in our DNAs. And I grew up thinking and hearing and feeling that the city could fall down to rubble and plummet all over again. And so there was a feeling of fragility, right? But also a feeling that if something like that happened, we knew how to react. And the truth is, we do. I went back to a text that I wrote like 5 years ago about growing up in the 80s in Mexico City and with that feeling and how that gave us a kind of reckless freedom. But I ended that text that the city hadn't plummeted and it wouldn't. I reread it just a few days ago thinking, oh no, well, it has again. And so how is my generation then going to respond to the fact that this happened? But now we're in our 30s. It's our duty as professionals to do what we can. So I sent the text to about 15 friends. They're writing back their own thoughts on the matter. People have responded saying, you know, thanks for like making me do this. I haven't been forced to write about this, and it's helped me find some kind of clarity. So I'm writing is not a good immediate response to emergency, but it can be a cure in the more long term.
And in the medium term, too. And in the very long term, before we let you go, once the structures are rebuilt, the houses are rebuilt and the churches, what do you want to come from all of this?
In many ways, I think that the civilian brigades turned into a civil power when one gets organized. And I think that 1985 can be an event that marked the beginning of the process that eventually it led to Mexico's first democratic government. And I think that now, in 2017, after all these years of the drug wars and political chaos and a level of normalized violence that no one can deal with anymore, maybe now, after this, there will be a heightened sense of civil power, of us being a huge brigade that can drive this government out and start something better.
Valeria Luiselli, author from Mexico City, the latest book, Tell Me How It Ends. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
According to the Sentencing Project, the national incarceration rate for women is 65 out of 100,000. But Oklahoma has a female incarceration rate more than double that. In Oklahoma, 151 women out of every 100,000 go to prison. That rate has doubled since 1990, and it's a big issue in Oklahoma. It's led to calls for reform from the state's Republican governor. But behind it all is a criminal justice culture where attitudes about women committing crimes mean get tough policies that jail more women in that state than anywhere else. Allison Herrera is a reporter for PRI who examined female incarceration in Oklahoma in partnership with Reveal, and she found it's an issue that goes back decades.
Oklahoma has held the dubious honor of having the number one female incarceration rate for the last 25 years, and that's according to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics. So Reveal and my co-reporter on this piece, Ziva Brandstetter, and I obtained the Department of Corrections data going back for 25 years to look at some of the reasons why women are being incarcerated at a high rate. And the number one reason is drug possession. Women are being locked up for drug crimes in other states, they have chosen to reduce and lower those sentences, but Oklahoma has not done that.
So what is it about Oklahoma or the legislators there or the justice system that views drug possession by women as worse than in other states?
There's several reasons. State legislators don't want to be seen as being soft on crime. The district attorney in Stevens County, which is a mostly rural county where Robin Allen, one of the women that we talked with for this story that we wrote, they pride themselves on having a very lock 'em up attitude when it comes to criminal justice.
Well, you mentioned Robin Allen, who was sentenced to 20 years for trafficking meth in Oklahoma. Let's hear from her.
I remember Mr. Pat. He used to be the officer that used to work A&R. And he said, Alan, he said, who did you make mad? And I said, what do you mean? He said, you have 20 years trafficking. He said, but these other two girls that are in here, one got 4 years, one got 5 years. They had a lot more methamphetamine than I did. They had a lot more drugs than I did.
Why was Robin Allen's sentence so harsh?
Well, in the data that we analyzed, Stevens County ranks third in sending women to prison for drug trafficking. Now, drug trafficking is she had 20 grams of methamphetamine, and that's just the right amount to be sentenced for that crime, which carries a heavy sentence. But she took what's called a blind plea, and the prosecutor actually recommended that she get 30 years. Then she argued it down to 20 years. I think it goes back to what we were just talking about earlier, that district attorneys are very powerful and they rely on this kind of lock 'em up attitude. They want to be able to keep their community safe.
Well, Allison Herrera, Oklahoma isn't the only state in America that has harsh attitudes about drugs. And certainly district attorneys in Oklahoma aren't alone in being under pressure from their constituents to lock people up. But you spoke to some experts about what might be going on in the state. Here's Susan Sharp, a retired sociology professor and expert on female incarceration at the University of Oklahoma.
I think the general population of the state feels that a woman, and particularly a woman who has children who uses drugs, violates all the norms in a way that they find unacceptable, and they would rather see those children grow up in foster care than to be with a mother who had a drug problem.
Yeah, Susan Sharp basically said, you know, poor women like Robin Allen and poor mothers in Oklahoma's rural areas, they're more likely to draw the wrath of judges and prosecutors. Wealthier women can afford private attorneys and they can get shorter sentences. But, you know, she spoke to the attitude that the state has towards women and that mothers are supposed to be caretakers of the children, and how dare they have a drug problem or, you know, sell drugs. And oftentimes, some of these women, like in Robin's case, are doing it to make money, to be able to support their family. And while not ideal, sometimes that's the only choice that they have. And I just want to be clear about one thing. It's not just one woman that's affected by incarceration. It's generations of Oklahomans that are affected by incarceration. So these women, they have children that were, you know, obviously affected by them going to prison. And oftentimes these mothers are the only one advocating or caretaking for their children. And when they go to prison, they're either left with family members, a father who could be on his way to prison himself, or in the state's foster care system. And what we've seen is then it's like the cycle repeats. Those young kids could be headed to prison themselves.
Does anyone in a position of power in the state of Oklahoma acknowledge that there's a major disparity here and that there might be a problem in Oklahoma, or are they more or less happy with the numbers they have?
No, people are very unhappy with this number. Governor Mary Fallon has recently warmed to criminal justice reform. The state passed two recent reforms, State Question 780, which would make simple possession of drugs and certain property crimes misdemeanors. The director of the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, Joe Alba, he's a Republican, but he has acknowledged the state needs to do something different.
Judges say, you know, you've been before me five times, Susie Jones, and there won't be a sixth time. I'm going to send you to prison so you can get some help. Practically, there is no help in prison. And there just is the belief that we ought to lock them up, throw away the key. And it doesn't work.
Well, Allison Herrera, it does sound like some powerful voices in Oklahoma are moving toward reform.
There are. But then there are some very vocal opponents against reform. Just last week, the Department of Corrections put out a press release saying that they were going to implement this community supervision program that would allow anybody within 18 months of their sentence to be released. But as soon as that press release came out, Representative Scott Biggs, one of the counties he represents is Stevens County, where Robin Allen is from, said that that was very reckless and that the Department of Corrections was putting citizens in harm's way. So while there are people that are definitely acknowledging the problem and saying we have to do something, there are people that don't agree with that. And they also have a very powerful voice in the legislature.
Oklahoma leads the way in incarcerating women much more than any other state. Allison Herrera is with PRI and has been reporting on those numbers in Oklahoma with Reveal. Allison Herrera, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
All this hour, we've been hearing from you about how the wildfires in California have affected you and the people that you love. We got this from Oakland. My sister and her family are all evacuated to my house in Oakland. They live 2 miles from the fire and technically could have stayed, but all the horrible stuff burning was too dangerous given my nephew's asthma. Earlier this hour, pulmonologist Zab Mosenifar had this advice for people affected by the smoke.
The best is really to stay indoors, to wear those N95 masks if you have to go outside, and make sure that you take your inhalers properly.
My name is Monica Morant, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. I'm quite disappointed and actually surprised that there's been no reporting, no commentary, but no mention of the farm workers, the wine country workers. I would imagine, given perhaps their undocumented status, that many are probably afraid to even self-report or report missing loved ones or go to the evacuation centers. Where are these workers? I would imagine they are the most impacted with nowhere to go.
We want to say that there were reports of undocumented immigrants being afraid to stay in evacuation centers in Northern California. The Sonoma County Sheriff denied the claim and said officials were not checking immigration status at those centers. Call us with your stories about the wildfires in Northern California, how they're affecting you, how they're affecting your families. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. Thank you so much for listening. In the meantime, I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time. By AliveCor, working to make heart monitoring simple, continuous, and digital. AliveCor's cardia devices deliver EKGs and detect atrial fibrillation right from the user's fingertips from anywhere. More at AliveCor.com. And Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at Westbridge.org.